This is Bristol, and you are listening to a podcast from the Bristol Confringe reading series.
Alrighty, folks, we're ready to get into the final part of the evening. Will, you might want to bring your chair around here because the microphone lead isn't terribly long. Thank you very much. Alrighty, so Nick, as you went first, we'll start as you. I gather you've been on a project management course today. So I was just wondering what is actually the function of a Gantt chart in defending the planet against an alien invasion? And do you think that the Doctor's adoption of a just-in-time miracle rescue is beneficial or harmful to the Earth security system?
All the Doctor Who, you can imagine all the really sort of serious Doctor Who villains being into project management and having their Gantt charts and dependencies all sorted out. I mean, it even expands to Star Wars. You can see the First Order all stood there, you know, with a Kylo Ren stood next to General Hux, and they've got their, nice glowing red things, all that. No, risk management, yes. There is a risk that the rebels will X, Y, Z, yeah. But the Doctor is completely against the project. He's anti all that, isn't he? He just fudges things at the last moment and always wins. The only trouble is, if I try explaining that to work colleagues and they take rather a dim view of it. You've got to do it the proper way in work, unfortunately, which makes my work colleagues analogous to the First Order. So I don't know what that means.
No. And just in time is a perfectly acceptable Japanese time management philosophy. You just have to explain to them that they haven't gone to the right courses and everything should appear at the last minute.
Well, just in time means just there's just in time and there's at the 11th hour, which is the title of what was the question again? Can we not talk about this bloody subject?
I knew we'd get our explicit tag eventually. Alrighty, so yeah, moving on then from project management to other forms of bureaucracy, you have an alien called Asbo.
The original Dominators were Dominator, Probationer, Toba, and Navigator, Rago. And so I was going through names of these Dominators, and they have to be simple names. And I just thought, wouldn't it be funny if you had one called Asbo, A-Z-B-O, because it's a bit like an Esbo. And I suggested it to the editor, and yeah, go for it. And I thought, I think he cottoned on to what I was doing there, that people... the characters in the story wouldn't know what it meant, but we could have a laugh. And the other character, the other Dominator, is Navigator Decca, D-E-K-A, which is named after Uncle Biffa Bacon's Uncle Decca out of Viz. If anybody knows Viz comic, Biffa Bacon, he's got Uncle Decca. So that was what. So and So I was asked to sort of sex up the Dominators a bit, make them a bit more credible, but. I don't know, you heard by reading earlier, they are nasty, but they're also incredibly stupid, and one of them just keeps on and on about destroying things, and the other one keeps berating him not to, and it just, the comedy value is irresistible, really. And the whole Asbo thing played into that.
And for the benefit of non-UK listeners on the podcast, an Asbo is an antisocial behaviour order, which is something that the police hand out to young people to stop them hanging around on street corners. And not just young people, no, they give them to Nick as well. final question for you, Nick, for now. The one thing I really want to know, is Robin Day in league with the Dominators?
If you like. He just interviews Director Var, which is that's the new level of Dominator hierarchy I thought up. They're all these, there's navigators, there's probationers, there's engineers, there's technicians, and the ones in charge of the project management is the Director Var. And actually in Mutually Assured Domination there's all little bits of work speak. You notice that Decca says to Asbo, you are not exhibiting the appropriate expected behaviours. And expected behaviours is a nasty little phrase I come across in the civil service, where in given situations, this is how they expect you to react, and it's quite nastily or Orwellian. And there's lots of stuff like that in Mutually Assured Domination. But Robin Day, no, as I said. And Russell Harty.
I have to explain who Robin Day and Russell Harty. I think Russell Harty had been on American television at some point or other, and Robin Day, if he hasn't been on American television, has probably been caricatured by somebody on American television. Bow ties and stuff like that. Yeah, before the Doctor had bow ties, Robin Day had bow ties. It's never been cool. Except for Ben Yallo, but that's another matter entirely. Which reminds me, coming on to Will, you clearly have a problem with democracy on board your pirate ship. And possibly people here won't understand this, but some of the people listening on the podcast, Will, what you actually need is Captain Stanley to confuse the ball with Robert's Rules of Order. If you can run a Wusfus business meeting like that, then you can certainly run a crew of drunk pirates, but never mind. So there's a lot of world building clearly gone into it. Would you perhaps like to tell us a little bit about this universe that you've created?
Yeah. it all stemmed from a thought of a world that didn't sort of operate. It was sort of a prototype world that basically fell off the workbench of the being before it became a being that became God, and created the universe, multiple universes and verses or whatever, and put them out, these universes, in the veggie plot to grow, because that's what the being before being who became a being actually did to create. He's the creator. And it was a little prototype where he was experimenting with the things, and so what you have is you have heaven and Merc, and to make the world go round, on heaven there's the this mixture called Ness is made, and then it's chucked off the end of heaven. And that propels it forward, and but Merc is always trying to chase heaven to be able to actually make the Ness, because then that would mean that the Merc and the Dark Lord will be actually ruling Glob instead of the other way around. And so this is what happens: is the flaw in the system, where the imps and little demons of Merc go and invade heaven, go and steal the recipe for Ness, and then go and try and start making Ness, which in Merc, which becomes Mess, and they're going to start bunging it off Merc, and so it's going to reverse the world. And so Ferzel, who was only there by mistake as a security guard, because heaven used to have a whole armies sort of guarding it against this eventuality of an invasion by the forces of Merc. The accountants have been in, and they thought, yeah, we don't really want that. It's rather a large expense, and they were rather noisy, and they kept on marching around and having parades and stuff like that. So they were got rid of, and a computer system went in. And unfortunately, this computer system had this one fault, and it sent this nut gatherer mystic probationer up to guard heaven, and he was rather a small, weedy, gangly little youth, and the armor didn't fit him, and he was being trained by the Bobo bird, which is the last warbird of Glob. That's where it started.
The thing that occurs to me is that in both of your stories, the villains are bureaucrats.
Maybe we like them, you know. Yes. And in fact, Merc is a rather large bureaucracy. Larger than heaven, in fact. But heaven's a nice place to be, on the whole.
Well, hopefully with no bureaucracy at all. I was reminded when you were going through the process of the border controls and whatever of Merc that there was a time when you had to pay to get out of Australia. I don't think they do that anymore.
Sorry, I was just going to say it reminds me of Jonathan Howard's Johannes Skibal books, where hell is very much a bureaucracy. And he has to use the bureaucracy of hell against it to try and get out of it.
Yes, so sadly Jonathan isn't here tonight to explain all of that to us, but there you go. Anyway, bureaucracy is clearly the bad guys today. On the other hand, comedy appears to be, and at least I think you were both trying to be funny, weren't you? I'm not in trouble here. It was supposed to be funny, wasn't it, Nick?
Yes, it was supposed to be funny. In writing this book, it's a serious adventure for the characters within it. It's a good old-fashioned romp, my book. And in it, there's lots and lots of little jokes, in-jokes that are funny. The way the dominators act and speak. For example, the way in the very beginning of the book, two of the characters turn up and the sign says, "Trespassers will be destroyed." And that becomes a plot point because the director says, "Come on, subordinates, we've done research and humans do not destroy each other for the crime of trespass. We must change it to prosecuted." So they change it and they can't spell prosecuted. So the humour comes naturally from the fact that the aliens, the dominators, were trying to fit in or trying to learn the language. That bit didn't come out in the bit I read out. So all of the humour in it comes from, it's not gratuitous, I hope, and the humour comes from the characters and the situations. And I don't think it's too over the top, but people who have read it have enjoyed it and have found it quite funny. So yeah, it is meant to be funny. God, it'd be awful if it was the other way around, wouldn't it?
And presumably these books are aimed at relatively young kids, but are also have things put in them for us adults to have a good laugh at too.
Yes, well, the remit is to make them like the target books, aimed at the intelligent 14-year-old. But I think when I'm writing things, I never, ever think about the audience. I just write the story. And I was told, don't put swear words in this, you know, because obviously it's aimed at the sort of the general Doctor Who fan. So I think it's aimed at any age, really. Slightly, maybe, not quite as the same age group as the new adventure Doctor Who books that were.
That's okay. No sex and violence. You're almost making it sound like the Doctor Who fan is an intelligent 14-year-old, but I'm sure I'm going to get shot for that. It goes along with the age-old Games Workshop philosophy that their products are aimed at boys between the ages of 14 and 16. Apparently below 14, they're not smart enough to understand the rules of the games. And at 16, they discover girls and motorbikes and are lost to the world of Games Workshop. Anyway, Will, is your work aimed at any particular age group, or did you just sit down and write what you thought would be fun?
Probably aimed at the eternally immature, I should mention. Just a bit of a romp, bit of people who've read it thought it feels like a cartoon, Tom and Jerry cartoon, where there's lots of bashing and sort of, but no one seems to die, sort of thing. It's that sort of harmless fun, but there's drinking involved with pirates and lots of knockout punch. So that's in this day and age where one drink is too many, no one's allowed to drink, it's totally irresponsible to drink, and then you have a knockout punch. So the basic idea is to down as much as possible and get completely brained, which is very sensible.
It sounds like most of the pirates I know. But of course, there is also this other question that your hero appears to be armed with a comfy chair.
Yes. When I was first started writing it, Jimmy Savile was quite a good guy, and he had a comfy chair. not the sort of thing that you actually mention these days. Jimmy Savile had a comfy chair where things appeared out of it, and not just used for paedophilia. So you don't really mention the Jimmy Savile connection these days, but that's what that when it was first sort of scudding around in my brain, "Jim will fix it" was one of those friendly sort of, well, child-friendly phrases.
Well, we've definitely got an explicit tag on this one.
Surely, comfy chair, Monty Python, did that not impinge?
That's what I was thinking of.
I could well have done.
Alrighty. If anybody asks, it's a Monty Python reference. Nothing to do with Jimmy Savile whatsoever. Right, has anybody else here got any questions for our readers? Come along, people. Am I going to have to get the thumb screws out or something? Oh, fluff? No. No, we can't mention fluffy cushions. We'll get banned from iTunes. It's going to be one of those evenings, isn't it? Nobody got any questions. Where's Justin when you need him? Okay, Roz is going to impersonate Justin for us.
No, I'm really not, but I will try to ask the kind of question that Justin likes to ask, because Justin always wants to get into kind of method and process and the structure of the novel. So I will ask you both, what was the most challenging aspect of writing your books?
Well, knowing that it will be scrutinised to an insanely detailed degree by Doctor Who fans, who can be a tad on the cruel side towards the object of their desire, venture onto Gallifrey base after an episode is aired and lose your faith in humanity. But I tried to put that out of my mind. That wasn't really the challenging bit. I find that it's the logistics, really, of it. Actual sitting down and writing is an absolute joy, but the planning and project management of it. Because you have to move characters around the world you've... No, but I did have a spreadsheet with characters' names along the top and the timeline down the side and where each character was in relation to another at a given time, so that you knew when some character's thinking or referring to another, you don't balls up the continuity. And Robin Day comes back into this because Panorama was on a Monday, always on a Monday, and the way I'd set things up... something was moved that made this Panorama broadcast appear in my novel on a Tuesday. And the editor was like, OK, we can say in the Whoniverse that Panorama was on a Tuesday. And I'm like, no, we want to get it as close. That's a bit pointless, you know. Get it as close to reality as possible. So I got the spreadsheet out, moved things around so that the Panorama did appear on a Monday. And it's the things like that. It's the planning out the project management stuff, which is the most boring. Hopefully this course I've just been on will help with this. But that was it, basically. And actually, the reviews, the fans of this book have been very, very positive. And so I'm quite pleased that I sometimes needlessly worry about people, what people are going to say. Because if you go onto IMDb and look at The Force Awakens, you either have glowing reviews and negative reviews. Whatever you write, somebody is not going to like it. But then again, people are going to like it. So as a writer, you have to separate yourself from that whole thing.
Will, do they watch Panorama in Merck?
No, nothing about Panorama in Merck or Tevin or on Gob. I found the most difficult thing was stopping the tap of the writing equivalent of verbal diarrhea. Really, it's sort of finding an ending and making it work, because it was just going on and on. And in fact, I wrote 120,000 words and then cut it back to 85, so chopping out large swathes of just stuff that wasn't quite core, I suppose. And there were several bits that I thought were nice, but didn't actually work in the general theme of things. But it was the editing that was difficult, and re-editing and chopping down.
Yeah. I think that's pretty much the same for any writing. I hate editing. Either of you road test your jokes with beta readers?
I have obviously the editor who will read, but I've got one or two people who I send my stuff to. I made a mistake when doing one Doctor Who novel of sending it, the first draft, to about 8 different people, and of course I got 8, and it was absolute murder, and brilliant suggestions from all these talented people, but it stopped the work in the book for a month while I sorted the wheat from the chaff. And in the end, with age, you realise you don't have to listen to anybody other except your editor, really. And so, yeah. Oh, I have one person who I trust to read my stuff. He is my, like, Padawan teacher, and that's Paul Leonard, Paul Hinder, who wrote some Doctor Who books in the past. He wrote The Turing Test, which is the best Doctor Who book ever written. Yeah, and he's still, you know... I'm trying to entice him back into the world of writing, but I'm not having much luck. He's my sort of guru, and he road tests my stuff, not just the jokes.
I have to admit that not really. In fact, I sent it out in the early days to people, and I obviously sent it out to, they were good friends, but obviously didn't have the same sense of humour. Didn't find it funny. Or sent it back saying, not my bag, sorry. Anything about cars?
Yeah, of course, Nick, if you send your novel out to 8 different people, you will get 64 different versions of what it is. Yes. That's the way it goes. However, I have just remembered, I have to ask you the important question. Is Brigadier Lethbridge Stewart in the book?
In what book? Yes. What is actually, he's Colonel, or a Brigade Colonel Lethbridge Stewart. Yeah, he just wasn't in the chapter that I read out.
That's very important, because I wouldn't buy the book if he wasn't in it. Oh dear, yes, all those Saturday afternoons watching Brigadier Lethbridge Stewart's show on the television and wondering who was going to play the Doctor in it. Alrighty, any more questions for our readers? Roz?
Well, just going back to what you said about finding an ending that worked, how do you know when you've got one?
Very difficult, because the first person I showed it to said, oh, it's predictable. So you just... if it works, just go with it, sort of. It's better than nothing, isn't it? Otherwise, you'll just keep on going and going and going. Don't know when to finish.
Or alternatively, you can use the Joe Hall method, and when there's nobody left alive, the book comes to an end. Nick, how do you find the end?
With this book, and with a lot of my Doctor Who books, the plot synopsis is worked out in advance, so the ending of this was always more or less worked out. But what I find at the ending is by the time you've written through the book and through the characters, certain things will have changed and certain things will have expanded. So I didn't find ending this one too bad, because obviously the Brigadier has to win, the Dominators have to be defeated. So the ending really didn't change, but the journey and the sort of little bits did. So I don't have a problem with endings, because I've worked them out in advance. I'm working on some stories now where if I haven't got that roadmap, it is a problem finding an ending, and I don't really know the answer to it, really, unless you've worked out the synopsis in advance.
Anybody else? Yes? No? Okay. Has anybody got any announcements? Any upcoming literary events and things? Joe?
Yes, I've got some. Okay, the 2nd of April, Rose and I are launching the Fight Like a Girl anthology, published by Crystal Inc. We're going to be launching that in the Hatchet from between 1 and 5. There is a buffet for which you have to pay £5, but you can get tickets for the buffet on Eventbrite. And if you don't want the buffet, then you can just turn up. But then you don't get any food.
Ceiling height notwithstanding, we are in negotiations with the Hatchet about this. There should be some form of swordplay. Fran Terminiello has a story in the book, and she's a dedicated FEMA member, and she's a bit of a swordmaster, so she's going to do something, and we may hopefully have some input from Juliet McKenna as well. Anybody here who's already seen her fighting knows that's going to be a huge treat. So fingers crossed for that, because it is venue dependent.
Yeah, and people who are already confirmed to come include Julian Knight, Katie Davis, Fran, and possibly Juliet, a couple of other people. So it's not, yeah, we're going to have actual big name authors there as well signing, and you can buy a copy and it will be a tenner. And that's going to be fab. Next Fringe is the 22nd of February. With Will McMillan Jones and Gareth Powell. So that's going to be in here. There is a pub night next week in here, which will be awesome. Monday. Everything is Mondays. Everything is always Mondays. Except BristolCon, which is a Saturday. What else? Yes, that was the thing. If anybody has anything that they've written that they feel is ready for submission, Crystal Inc. are opening to submissions on the 1st of February for about 2 months. So if you have got anything that you think is pretty much ready, polish it and send it in. Novels, yes. We will take novellas. We will also take previously self-published books. So that is because I am their new acquisitions editor, so I will be acquiring stuff. So that's going to be fun. Send me your good stuff. 1st of February till, I believe it's the end of April. I will. The confirmed dates are on the Facebook page for the Fancy SF Society, but I can post them again. But it's definitely the whole of February and the whole of March, and I think it might be the whole of April as well.
Okay, because we've been meaning to talk more about this, the Fight Like a Girl launch is the first project of 2016, which is being backed by the Bristol Con Foundation. And so just to remind people that for local projects in genre fiction or related activities, so it can be art, it can be theatre, but it has to have a genre aspect and it has to be local, you can apply for grants from Bristol Con for up to £200. And, you know, we're very nice. We're very approachable, and we want to help. So do come and ask us for money if you have a project.
Doesn't cover producing hardback books, unfortunately, but never mind. However, mention of Juliet McKenna reminds me that the latest book in her Aldebrecht & Compass series, which is Western Shore, is going to be out later this week. I posted the cover on my blog today, and as and when I can finally get it uploaded to Amazon and they approve it and whatever, then it will be on sale and I will let you know so you can all go out and buy it. Tom?
Well, firstly, I just want to say that the storytelling event that I did just before Christmas, the podcast has now gone live, which has Jo reading her lovely Christmas story, The Bauble, with your amazing Scottish accent, Jo. So that's on www.stokescroftwriters.com, and then you just go to the Talking Tales tab, and it's the latest podcast. It's the December podcast. You know, appreciating that, you know, people aren't listening to this podcast straight away. They could be listening to it years in the future, so it'll be December 2015. And our next storytelling event is in Stokescroft at the Left Bank on the 20th of February, so 2 days before the next Bristol Con. So ours is a Saturday. And yes, there'll be a lot of local authors doing 10-minute short story submissions. And again, details for the next one is always on the Stokescroft Writers website.
Any more announcements? Alrighty, so that's just me then. This is not terribly much to do with science fiction, but if you want to know what I am doing, February is LGBT History Month, so I'm going to be kind of busy, and I'm sort of going on tour around the country doing talks and stuff like that. But for the week, February the 15th to 21st, that's Monday to Sunday, I'm going to be in Bristol because we have a whole load of events planned, some of which are already up on Facebook, others of which will be going up in the next week or so. Definitely over the weekend, 20th, 21st, there's going to be a whole load of people, well, on the Saturday, a whole load of people from around the country dropping in on the M-Shed, giving lots of interesting talks of different aspects of LGBT history. And on the Sunday, on the 21st, we're doing local history stuff. So that should be well worth coming to see. I'll be probably on the Sunday talking about Michael Dillon and lots of other interesting people too. So do come along if you have time, because it's all free. And I'll also be in London on the 6th of February, and in Manchester the following weekend, which will be like the 27th. Anybody else got any announcements? No? In which case, next Fringe will be in here, and I will actually be in Bristol on the 22nd. So I will see you all then. Thank you very much.
Bristol Con Fringe is a monthly reading series produced by the Bristol Con Foundation. Our thanks to the Shakespeare Tavern for providing us with a venue. The music at the beginning of this podcast is The Future by Chevy 174.